Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back. We're going to get off to a fast start by calling you, or you calling me rather, at 888-914-9149. Let's go straight to Peggy in Chicago. Good morning, Peggy. Hello, Peggy. Peggy in Chicago, you're on the air. Welcome.
Bueller.
Yeah.
Shoot me some info. Go ahead.
Okay, Peggy, stand by. We'll come back to you. We'll see what's going on. Let's go to Ann now in Lake County, Illinois. Good morning, Ann. Cyrus, I got a bad feeling about this.
I have a bad feeling about this, too.
What's happening?
Hold on. I'll try putting them on. Boy, I'm having deja vu here.
I know. All over again.
I'm going to put them on hold, and then I'm going to put Ann on the second channel. Maybe we can be lucky.
Okay.
Hey, Ann, can you hear us? All right.
You have to.
I'll call in the engineers.
That routine maintenance is, we got to continue. So I tell you what, everybody who's holding on the phones, that's all 500 of you. Please be patient. We want to go to you. We're having an issue. We'll find out what it is as quickly as possible, and we'll get you on the air. So please stand by. In the meantime, though, I have a note that came in from Laura, and Laura is listening on the Relevant Radio app. She says, "Hi, Patrick. There's a recovery group called Celebrate Recovery that was founded by Pastor Rick Warren of Saddleback Church 25 years ago. It is a Christ-centered recovery program that collapses the 12 steps from AA into 8 principles."
Hello?
Yeah, Cyrus, you're on the air, by the way.
Oh.
Cyrus. You don't want to be on the air right now, Cyrus. It's a Christ-centered recovery program that collapses the 12 steps from AA into 8 principles. The principles are based on the scriptures and emphasize a personal and intimate relationship with Jesus Christ. There is a lot of praise and worship music, evangelical style. I like the fellowship better than the secular AA meeting because it focuses on God's healing and sacrificial graces. I am the only Catholic in the group. Do you think it's okay for me to participate in this fellowship? God bless you and all you do. Thank you, Laura. Well, I am not familiar with it. I do kind of like Pastor Rick Warren. I've never met him. I'd like to have a purpose-driven cup of coffee with him one of these days. But I think he exhibits a lot of genuine, good pastoral sense. Now, obviously, he and I would disagree maybe on some doctrinal issues. But I like to give credit where credit is due. So although I'm not familiar with this particular program, some of the things I have seen from him, I have thought have been helpful. So maybe what I need to do is take a look at the 8 steps in this program and offer some thoughts that way. But just off the cuff, if you are, and I'll put it in these terms here. If you are in recovery and you are emotionally vulnerable, and I think anybody who's in recovery, especially if you're going to meetings like this where you're around other people, who are not only sharing their own deep feelings, but also there to give emotional support to people and to receive emotional support. This for me would be maybe a bit of a red flag for this reason, because if you're there, you said you're the only Catholic, you are in a position where your emotions are going to shape the way in which you interact with these people. And for the better, meaning that they will come to be your friends, most likely, or at least some of them will, and you will develop emotional bonds with these people. There's nothing wrong with that, don't get me wrong, but under the circumstances, because it is a religiously focused meeting and certain, in this case, Protestant ideas and notions and things are inevitably going to be woven into that, and it will be taking place at a time when you are emotionally vulnerable and you're likely to enjoy more and more and more what you're experiencing there, the danger, if you ask me, is that some of these erroneous notions can slip in with all the other good stuff that's coming in. And that could wind up, and sometimes these things do happen, where the Catholic just winds up saying, well, I don't want to be Catholic anymore. I want to go to these people's church. And it's not so much because of a doctrinal issue per se, is that they feel now comfortable with their new family, their new set of friends. And I'm sure they're fine people. And I'm sure that everything is on the up and up. So I'm not trying to suggest otherwise. But as a human being with emotions, don't underestimate the ability for something like this, even though it's benign, to have an influence on you in a way that could wind up leading you out of the church. And I don't say this because I think there's anything weak or wrong about you, but it's just human nature. And I've seen it happen endlessly over and over throughout the years, where Catholics are well-meaning. They send their kids, let's say, to the local quote-unquote Christian school. It might be run by the Baptist church, might be non-denominational. And in many respects, it's a great school. And the Catholic student goes there in good faith. And before you know it, by the time the student graduates, the student doesn't want to go to the Catholic church anymore because he's made new friends and he's been really sort of worked on an ongoing basis by these well-meaning Protestant folk. And now that student no longer wants to be Catholic. This is a very common situation. So that would be the one and only red flag I would raise for you. And the fact that, you know, interestingly, the fact that you took time to write this note to me makes me think that perhaps you yourself are a bit unsettled and that you're thinking somewhere in the back of your mind that maybe this might not be good for you. So I would say if you're going to go, have one or two or three even Catholic friends with you. If they're in recovery, great. And even if they're not, and use the buddy system and make sure that you're not the lone Catholic there, because for the reasons I just mentioned, I think you get the idea. 888-914-9149. Let's see if we can get back to the phones. Cyrus is giving me the thumbs up. Peggy in Chicago, we'll start over again. Welcome. Hello, Peggy. Well, see? Peggy in Chicago.
See, thumbs up.
I was told that there would be tacos. I was told that there would be working phone lines. We'll try it again. Stay there, Peggy. We'll try Ann in Lake County, Illinois. Hello, Ann.
Hello, this is Ann.
All right.
Okay,
we're batting 500. Welcome, Ann.
I have two questions. The first is, what do you tell a teenager that is saying, how can we love a merciful, loving God that we see in the New Testament when we look at all of the massacres and the stories where, you know, millions of people were killed, whether it be Babylon or Noah's Ark?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so is there references or anything like that that you would?
Yeah. References that I would what, Ann?
Hello, are there any books or references that you could give to that teenager?
Okay, yes. The book that comes to my mind is God a Moral Monster by Paul Copan, C-O-P-P-A-N. Is God a Moral Monster? So he takes on this very question, this argument, and there's a lot to it, but there's no doubt that God did indeed punish the world for the sins that were going on at the time of Noah and the flood. In fact, Jesus himself refers to this as an historical event when he says, just as it was in the days of Noah when they were carrying on and they didn't realize what was going to happen until the day the flood came and carried them all away, so will it be in the day when the Son of Man returns. So Jesus himself reminds us that this terrible punishment that was inflicted by God killed everybody, not just people in certain localized places. So part of the answer to the question is that God in his justice does punish people. And sometimes the punishments are severe. And this is difficult for us because, you know, we think in terms of, well, I would like to spare my children from something, some suffering or some kind of punishment. But God reminds us, you know, as high as the sky is above the earth, so are my ways above your ways. And so I think part of the answer, even though this may not immediately be satisfying emotionally, is that we have to adopt a posture of humility and recognize that just because I wouldn't do it that way doesn't mean that God shouldn't do it that way. Or just because I think that God is being too harsh, that doesn't mean he is being too harsh. He does everything perfectly. And in those situations where he deemed some severe punishment to be necessary, well, he's God. And he knows all that can be known about it. I don't know anything about it. All I know is what I read in the Bible, and I draw my own conclusions. But I would say if God, as God, decided to do this, he had a good reason for it. Now, another thing would be that in this book, Is God a Moral Monster?, to take into account some of the hyperbolic language that's used in Scripture, for example, where Joshua and other instances where the Israelites are sent against certain peoples, the Amorites, the Jebusites, the Canaanites, and all the ites that were running around over there, and God would say, go in there and kill them all. Kill all the cattle, kill all the women, kill all the children, kill all the men, kill everything. And what he points out, and I think that this explanation makes a lot of sense, he says, but look, if you notice as you go further into Bible history, you see all these same groups still there, which leads us to conclude, or at least it's a reasonable conclusion, that when he said this, he didn't mean it in a literal sense. Like when I said, if I'm late for dinner, my wife will kill me. I don't mean that literally, because she's not going to kill me. But it's a figure of speech. So one plausible way of understanding these passages is that the people understood that God didn't mean this literally. They would go in and they'd do battle against them and the men would get killed and so forth. But they didn't completely wipe them out the way it seems God told them to do, because you still see these people after the fact. That makes sense to me. And I find that as a plausible conclusion. And then the last thing I would say is that maybe this is not a perfect analogy, but just as when a child is small and you might use corporal punishment, a spanking or grounding or something like that, when the child grows up or even before he's fully grown, those ways of disciplining a child are no longer appropriate. They no longer work. And so another view of this is that as God more and more revealed himself in Jesus Christ, the emphasis turned away from punishment, at least in this life so much, and more toward mercy and dealing with people at a more mature level. I think there's something to be said for that as well. But I think the book will help if you give him that and maybe look into it yourself. I think you'll find it at least helpful in assuaging some of these concerns.
May I ask one last question?
Sure.
I live in the Lake County, and we've got a large Jesuit school in the Wilmette area, and it's extremely progressive, woke, especially in the theology department. And it seems like even from the school level all the way up to the Midwest Jesuit that, you know, they've drunk the Kool-Aid. And can you explain to me why you think that is? Because I do love St. Ignatius and all of what he represents and the, you know, the spiritual journey that, you know, you can go through. I just can't believe it is so woke and that literally in this, anything that they select is, has either a twist of socialism or a total woke perspective.
Okay. I understand. Yeah, the answer is no. I can't explain it. I don't know what's happened and I don't know all the causes of it, but somebody who used to be a Jesuit priest, his name was Malachi Martin. He wrote a book called The Jesuits, and it is a long, and by long, I mean maybe, I don't know, 600 pages. It's an historical overview of what he believes happened to the Jesuits. Now, he died in the late 1990s, and he was a Jesuit in the early part of the 20th century, and he left the order. And he himself, I mean, he's somewhat of a mysterious figure, and he's controversial in his own right. But he, as a member of the Society of Jesus, he had the inside track and knew many of the people who were involved in the massive changes that took place within the order in the 20th century. So if you're looking for a book by an insider who gives his take on it, that's the book I would recommend.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Phil now in New Bedford, Mass. Good morning, Phil. Hello, Phil.
Patrick.
Yeah.
Hi. I was just wondering, and I've heard you explain this previous times in other circumstances, but cooperation with evil as far as tobacco farmers are concerned, I didn't know if that was a thing.
Yeah, that's a like
the guy
that's
is just out there
question.
Picking the tobacco leaves. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is their cooperation with evil?
Well, if the evil that you have in mind is people dying of lung cancer or other forms of cancer because they smoke
exactly.
cigarettes, yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a connection, but I think in the case of the poor guy with the machete who's just trying to make a living to feed his family, I don't think that he's morally culpable in the way that, let's say, the big tobacco companies are. They're morally culpable in something that's destructive of human beings. But the guy with the machete just trying to make ends meet, I don't think he is, because he doesn't intend to do harm to anybody. This may be the only way that he can survive and feed his family. He's participating, but at a remote level. And
right.
So for that reason, I don't see him as being culpable. And if he is culpable in God's eyes, then I would think that it's a very, very minimal culpability. Unlike, say, the Philip Morrises of the world.
Sure. Stands to reason. I mean, like I said, I've heard you explain it a bunch of times previously, and just wondering if it applied to this situation in particular.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it does apply, but it seems to me that it's so remote that it's not that he himself is not in any moral danger. But this is an important question you're asking, Phil, because this is the kind of thing that we should do with just about anything. We should examine the moral quality of a human act and determine, is this moral? Is this immoral? And if so, why? If not, why not? The more people listening to this program and the more you and I take it upon ourselves to really reflect upon the moral quality of the things that we do, the better off we're going to be, because we're not going to make mistakes as much. We're not going to veer off into participating in something that we realize this is wrong. I really can't do this. Reminds me, Phil, if you don't mind me adding this, reminds me of a friend of mine who was a pharmacy. He owned a pharmacy, and he was doing very, very well as the owner of this pharmacy. But when he had made the decision that he was not going to sell contraceptives, and so that was his conscience stand. It sounds like you're assembling a model or something like that in the background. He took a stand and said, I'm not going to sell contraceptives. And he lost business, and people went across the street to the other pharmacy, that kind of thing. Well, as I recall, eventually it got to the point where he decided he would sell his business, partly so he could maybe move toward retirement, but also because he was more and more now being sort of boxed into a corner where he would have to do things like that were against his conscience. So he just simply said, no, I'm not going to do it. And he sold his pharmacy. So to my mind, Phil, I'll leave you with this thought. That to me was an edifying example of a Catholic man who realized that the best thing for him to do was to remove himself from the situation so that he wouldn't be tempted to compromise. And that can come with a real cost, but it was helpful to me. And I hope that's helpful to you, Phil. Thank you. Break time. We're coming right back. And that number again, 888-914-9149. I have an email that comes in, a question about Mary as a single mom, the Blessed Virgin Mary. Is she a single mom? I'll tell you the answer to that when I come back right after this. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Let me ask you, can the Catholic Church have a future if we Catholics don't understand our past? Experience history the way it should be taught in a free online class from Christendom College. Just go to principlesclasses.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Hey, man. Welcome to the Patrick Madrid Show. If you're just tuning in, you like that, Cyrus?
I did like that. That's good.
Yeah. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. Good bass on this song, Cyrus. Yeah. Good bass. Love it. 888-914-9149. This is a note that came in a while back from Susan, listening in Philadelphia on our 640 AM station. Subject, Mary and single moms. She says, I have a daughter who is a single mom. She has been raising her son in the Catholic Church, active in CYO and religious prep. She has enrolled him for the fifth grade, and this year is a coach for the track team. So last night we had our Tuesday talk, and she made a statement that I did not know how to answer. We were talking about how she feels left out from all the parish activities, which seem to forget about single parents, and she feels uncomfortable at times. She said, how come Mary has a place of honor in the church, although she was a single mother? How do you explain to a single mother why Mary is honored in the church and brought forth a son, as well as, so my daughter wants to know why the single mothers are not honored in the church? Very good question. The first part of my answer would be, Mary was not a single mother. This is a common trope nowadays, but strictly speaking, it's not true, because Mary was betrothed to Saint Joseph. And unlike nowadays, when people don't typically get betrothed, they get engaged, but it's not the same thing. In Judaism, the religion of the temple at that time, the first phase of marriage was known as betrothal. So they were indeed married. This is why when Saint Joseph discovered that Our Lady was expecting baby Jesus, one of the thoughts that came to his mind was, maybe I should divorce her. You divorce a wife, you don't divorce a girlfriend. So that's added biblical evidence that Mary was indeed already married, but in the first phase of marriage, which was the betrothal phase. And then the second phase was when the two would have the wedding, kind of the final wedding ceremony. They had a betrothal ceremony before that. And then the final ceremony was where they would begin living together. So Mary, this is why people who say, well, Mary was a single mother, it's just not true. She was not an unwed mother. She was betrothed to Saint Joseph, and that's not a word game. It really meant the first phase of marriage. So that's the first thing I would say to your daughter. And the second thing is that it's not as though, you know, the Catholic Church, we're going to honor Mary, but we're not going to honor unwed mothers. And think of the reason why, because how do you become an unwed mother? Now, you know the answer to that, and I know the answer to that. But for the sake of it, let's just say that the way you become an unwed mother is, outside of something horrible like rape, for example, you commit the sin of fornication. That's how you become an unwed mother. That's the only way you can become an unwed mother, because if you're married and you and your husband have a baby, well, there's no dishonor in that. There's no sin in that. That's the way marriage is intended by God. So you might ask her this question. Not only after you point out to her that Mary was not an unwed mother, then say, why would the church honor the status of being an unwed mother? Why? Because the only way you can become an unwed mother is to commit a sin. And just leave her with that thought. That's not a put down. That's not judging her. God is the one who judges, not me, not you. God is the one who judges. Now, we can judge actions, and we can say, don't commit the sin of fornication. You can judge actions, of course. You can't judge people's hearts, and that's not what I seek to do. But if you help her see that it would be pointless, maybe there's a better word for it, I just can't think of it right now, but it would be pointless for the church to quote-unquote honor an unwed mother because she's an unwed mother, it doesn't make any sense. And I think you get the idea. So I realize this is a delicate issue and your daughter's emotions are in play. I understand that. But maybe if you shared those ways of looking at it with her, it would help her see this. Now, it doesn't mean that she's stuck in the unwed mother category forever. Hopefully she'll find a man and she can get, and get married to and have a wonderful, happy relationship. But unwed mother is not a status of honor for anybody. It doesn't mean that the church turns her back on women who are unwed mothers. Not at all. It's all about hope and encouragement. It's all about love and forgiveness and compassion and all the things that the Lord extends to everyone, the rest of us. That just happens to be one way that somebody can fall into a serious sin. There are many other ways. And the church is there with redemption and salvation and forgiveness and the sacraments, because all that comes from God, of course, for everybody. But being an unwed mother, that category is not something worthy of celebration. We celebrate the child. We celebrate the fact that the mother chose life, all of the above. I think you get the idea. I hope that's helpful. 888-914-9149. How about Edgar now in Atlanta? Good morning, Edgar.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a question from my 10-year-old son that I wasn't able to answer.
Okay.
Does the church teach that there's a difference between Protestants and those in schism like the Orthodox? And if so, which one of those groups would you put the set of Acontists in?
Ah, okay. He's 10 years old and he's asking you that question? That's pretty amazing. You've raised a smart kid.
We were just talking about the different sects, you know, that we see around here. We're kind of in the Protestant Bible Belt, and there's lots of different churches trying to explain the differences.
Okay. Let's begin here. So point out to him, first of all, let's make this our starting point, that Jesus Christ established a church. And that church is the Catholic Church, capital C Catholic, with all that that entails. Jesus, point out to your son, Jesus said that the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, a little tiny speck of a seed. And he says it grows into this huge tree-like plant, basically the size of a tree. Now, it's the same organism, it's the same thing, but it looks very different in its mature form than it looked in its seed form, but it's the same thing. Like an acorn growing into an oak tree. That oak tree is the result of that one particular acorn. And the reason I think it's important to point this out is to say the church that Jesus established that we read about in the book of Acts, it's not going to look like the church does now. You're not going to see Vatican City State. Nobody is called archbishop. You won't see things about how you have to fast for 1 hour before receiving Holy Communion. Those are all things that over time organically develop, just like this mustard seed grows into a giant tree. But the thing is, it's still the same church. It's the one church that Christ established, the Catholic Church. And when I say capital C, what I mean is it's not like this amorphous notion about it's a universal church where kind of everybody is sort of all on the same page and we more or less agree on the same things. That's not it at all. It was a specific church with specific doctrines and specific practices. And that church is traceable throughout history from the time of Jesus to the present time, or to go backward in time. You can trace the Catholic Church, capital C, all the way back to the time of the apostles. In fact, that's when we first begin seeing that they're calling the church the Catholic Church, capital C. So the reason that's a good, important foundation, if you ask me, is because then you can see, well, where did these other churches come from? And what we know as today as the Orthodox churches, prior to the 11th century, they were all part of the Catholic Church. Now, not to give you too deep of a history lesson, Edgar, but a lot of it has to do with history. And in the case of the Emperor Constantine in the early 4th century, he got it into his head that he would move the seat of the Roman Empire from Rome to Byzantium, which was a little fishing village that he had laid claim to, and he built this spectacular, sparkling city that became known as Constantinople, named after him. So he, as the Roman Empire emperor, moved his throne to there, and he set up a kind of a co-emperor arrangement where there was like this also-ran wannabe emperor that he installed in Rome to sort of govern the western part of the empire. But the real, you know, the real action was in Byzantium, was in Constantinople. So what happened was, over time, several things happened. Number one, over centuries and centuries, the Greek aspect of the church began to develop in its own ways, maintaining the same body of doctrine and the same beliefs and the same sacraments, etc. But language and custom and other things were developing as they naturally do. And in the West, they were also developing. But one thing that the Latin part of the empire had to deal with that the Eastern part didn't, at least not yet, was the invasion of the various hordes that came in, the barbarians that came in from Europe and sacked Rome over and over again. Eventually, by the time you get to the 6th century, Rome had been overcome and basically overrun by the Visigoths. And so there was no more Roman Empire in that part of the empire. It had now been taken over by these invading groups. The Catholic Church was still there. The Pope was still there. Everything was still functioning. But the eastern part of the church, it was preserved for the next roughly 2 centuries from those incursions from the Visigoths and the other invading hordes that came in until Islam showed up and did the same thing to them. And then they eventually were conquered and subdued. And Constantinople is now known as Istanbul because it has been in the hands of the Muslims for 1,000 years. So the reason this history lesson is important is to understand why there even are what we call Orthodox churches. By about the year, or by about the 11th century, the division between the West and the East became so pronounced that for political reasons, economic reasons, some theological reasons also, and language reasons, there was a definitive pulling away. And those churches that we know of today, so let's take, for example, the premier church, which would be the Greek Orthodox Church, they formally severed their communion with the Catholic Church. Now, they would claim that the Catholic Church left them and that they are really the guardians of tradition, to coin a phrase, and that they are the ones who really preserve the Catholic faith and that it's the Latins who left and went haywire. The historical evidence demonstrates that it's exactly the opposite. But point being, that's where these churches came from, which means that they have valid sacraments. They have valid holy orders. That's why they have valid sacraments in the case of the Holy Eucharist, etc. So their divine liturgy is, in fact, a valid Mass. They don't call it the Mass, but you get the idea. So there's a huge distinction here between in the 11th century when those regional churches broke communion with the Catholic Church and they pulled away, they maintained the authentic Catholic faith even though they've divorced themselves from the church that they left. That's not what happened in the case of the Protestant revolt. So we go now 500 years into the future. So now we're in the 16th century and we see certain Catholics like Martin Luther and John Calvin and others who began, it seems, that they wanted to recover what they understood to be the original Catholic Church, but it was simply trying to reshape the church according to their own notions about how they were interpreting Scripture, rejecting the 1,500 years of church tradition that came before that. And what I mean by tradition is the church's norm for interpreting Scripture. They rejected that, and whether wittingly or unwittingly, they found themselves as the progenitors, the founders of new religions, known as Lutheranism and Calvinism and Anabaptism. And those are the three major branches that began at the beginning in the 16th century. And then, of course, that proliferated into fragmentation and further fragmentation and people disagreeing about what the Bible meant. And even those first three branches, Lutheran, Calvinist, and Anabaptist, they couldn't agree among themselves what the Bible meant, even though they all claimed to go by the Bible alone. And the distinctive here is that unlike the Greek Orthodox Church and some of the other what we regard to be Orthodox churches, unlike them, they took an axe to the church's teaching on things like the sacraments, and they repudiated and spurned the church's teaching on transubstantiation, the Mass as a sacrifice, the priesthood, etc., so that when they left, they didn't bring with them valid holy orders. They didn't bring with them valid sacraments in the case of, say, the Holy Eucharist. So their ministers could no longer celebrate Mass, even if they wanted to, which they didn't. So they lost touch entirely with that aspect of validity in the Catholic Church in terms of the sacraments. And so they basically hived off with their Bibles in hand, which amounted to ultimately kind of a private play toy for them. It was, what do I think this means? And if I don't agree with what he says, then I'm going to go with my interpretation and form my own church. And in due time, somebody that's in my church that I formed won't agree with what I'm teaching from the Bible. So he's going to leave and start his own church, bereft of the Eucharist, bereft of holy orders, etc. So there's a vast difference between the Eastern Orthodox churches that do have those valid aspects of the true faith and the world of Protestantism that has none of them. I mean, they have valid baptism, and we can say that their marriages can also be sacramental if they're both baptized, but other than that, no. No valid confirmation, no valid Holy Eucharist, no valid confession, no valid holy orders, no valid extreme unction, also known as holy anointing. Those are all gone in that world. So how about that for a long and winding road of an explanation? If you're interested, I have to take a break, Edgar. Maybe you can share with your son a book. It may be too much for him to read, but if you were to read it, you could help him understand it. It's called Rome in the Eastern Churches, and it's by Father Aidan Nichols, N-I-C-H-O-L-S. He's a scholar at Oxford. Not Oxford, excuse me. He's a scholar at Cambridge. And it's a very helpful theological overview of this issue, Rome and the Eastern Churches. Thank you, Edgar. I'll be right back right after this. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Real life solutions you can believe in. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Gotcha.
Yes, you did. You got me. I was all geared up for...
Yeah, at the break, he asked me, he's like, hey, how about some magic carpet ride? I'm like, yeah, I got just the thing.
That's like half a carpet. Well, you know what? I created this monster, so I have to live with it. That was funny, though. Hey, before I get back to the phones, and I'm going to get back there here real quick, the number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I want to take a note here that just literally came in within the last, I don't know, 20 minutes or so from Joe listening in Fort Worth, Tejas. And he says, Patrick, I was just thinking about the caller who asked about the two different gods of the Old and the New Testament. You always seem to have a ready resource for various common questions. I was wondering, do you have a cheat sheet? The reason that I ask is that as an historian, we often write historiographies on a particular topic where we go through various schools of thought and recount the major works in each school. And the thesis of those books is to show how the understanding of a subject has evolved. Here's my question. Have you ever thought of writing something similar to a historiography? If you have a cheat sheet, you are already well on your way. You could group various objections to and myths about the Catholic religion, explain how they arose, and provide various works that have done a good job of debunking them. You could call it Madrid's Comprehensive Defense of the Faith. It would be your magnum opus. Well, first of all, Joe, thank you. I appreciate you taking time, and it's a very thoughtful email that you sent. I appreciate it very much. I don't know that I ever will write exactly that kind of a book, but over the years, I've written 26 books. The most recent, of course, is the little book called Inquisition, that fun Catholic quiz book. But I've written some other books that are much more, you know, I would say much more substantive. And the one that comes to mind that is kind of like that on a topic is called Pope Fiction. And it's not exactly what you're describing here, but it might be something close to what you have in mind. Over the years of doing public speaking, I was fielding questions all the time about different aspects of the papacy, some of them biblical, some of them historical, some of them dealing with, like, well, what about the original Greek? You know, Jesus says, upon this rock, I will build my church. And it's a feminine noun, but he uses a masculine pronoun. Did he even say it in Greek? Questions like that. And what happened was, over the years of answering questions about these, I would have to recommend a variety of different books. Well, this book will answer that question. That book will answer that question. So one day, I got a bright idea, and I thought, well, what if I wrote a book that would assemble all the major questions and some of the minor ones on this issue of the papacy, and write a book that would address all of them in one volume? So that rather than have to recommend 10 different books, I could recommend one book, happened to be my book, but I could bring to bear all of those years of fielding the same questions over and over again and say, well, here is like a one-stop shop. So I did that. Now, I don't know if that exactly corresponds with what you have in mind, but it might. So that book, for what it's worth, is called Pope Fiction, Answers to 30 Myths and Misconceptions About the Papacy. And then another book, I mean, there's several other books that are similar to this that focus on different aspects of the faith. But another book is called Envoy for Christ. And that one came out 10 years ago. It's hard to believe now. Envoy for Christ, 25 years as a Catholic apologist. It's coming up on 36 years now. But that book is also a kind of A to Z compendium of many of the articles that I had written over the years, some of which were lost because they were no longer available online, or they were published in publications that went out of print, so they're no longer available in paper copy. So I, working with my publisher, we got a large, and it's a rather large book too, a large amount of and a great variety of different topics that I've dealt with over the years. And one of the things about that book, it's called Envoy for Christ, is that I interspersed a lot of these older essays and articles with reflections about, well, what was I thinking about when I wrote this? Or what would I do differently if I had to write this again? And so there's a lot of kind of looking back and offering further reflection on that. That too may be something along the lines of what you have in mind. So if you have a chance and you want to peruse those books, you can see them by going to the show page. It's relevantradio.com/Patrick. Click on links and then click on the section for, I think it's the books. You'll find it there. So thank you again for that. And I appreciate your thoughtful email. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to John in Florida. Hello, John.
Hi, Patrick. My question is in regards to my family. My wife, after her third C-section, her doctor, who happened to be Catholic as well, convinced her that getting a C-section during her fourth pregnancy would be the best thing to do. Excuse me. She would have to have a fourth C-section, and to get her tubes tied, for better lack of clarification, would be the best thing to do for her health. So she truly believed that and made that decision, despite me, you know, not agreeing. Yeah. So that happened. And then since that time, I've gotten her and myself, we both have gone to confession about it. And I've told, you know, I the priest told me, well, you know, basically what's done is done, and you've confessed for it, and that's it. And I think I even brought up a second time, to which you reminded me, you've confessed this, it's over. But I just wanted to clarify, what is that true? Because we continue to, and you know, have the marital act after what's been done, but we can no longer, you know, because of the tubes being tied, can no longer have children at this time.
That's right. Yes. And your conscience is still bothering you, isn't it?
It does.
Yeah. And it's understandable, because there's unfinished business left there, and it falls into the category of restitution. So I'll put it this way. I would agree with the priest in the sense that it is done. You committed the sin. You were sorry for the sin. You repented of the sin, and you went to confession, and you received forgiveness for the sin, both you and your wife. But what the reason your conscience is bothering you is that you know now that you're enjoying the good and the pleasure of the marital act with zero responsibility, because there's no possibility that human life could arise from this. And the reason your conscience bothers you is, as I was saying, there's unfinished business here. So the church does not say that you must pursue a reversal of the tubal ligation. And, you know, for some people, it's not possible because of the cost. And it may not be possible in some cases because it's not available. But here in these United States, tubal ligations are easily reversed. It's a very common procedure. It's widespread. I'm not going to say common like, you know, everybody's doing it. I don't mean that. But it's easy to obtain. There's no difficulty. You don't have to climb over a mountain range to get to a place where they can do that. It's readily available. And the cost is not prohibitive. So my advice would be, although the church doesn't say that you must do this, and I'm speaking to you and your wife both, the better thing to do is to pursue that and to restore, if at all possible, and it's almost always possible, to restore what was damaged. It's a form of restitution, and you'd be helping to not only satisfy injustice, what, you know, the results of this sin, but also you bring your marriage back into conformity with God's will for marriage, and that is that you be open to the possibility of life. It doesn't mean that you have to have more children. God makes that decision with you. But at least be open to that and not using the marriage act in a way that's purely for pleasure, which is what it ultimately becomes in a case like this. And believe me, as you already know, the pleasure is fantastic, and there's a lot to be said for it. But if it's divorced from the responsibility and the openness to God's will in your life, then it becomes a cause for your conscience to bother you and bother you and bother you. So if your wife were to have her tubes if she were to reverse the tubal ligation, another huge benefit is suddenly now that nagging conscience goes away. And the two of you will not have to worry about this anymore. Whether or not you have other children, you'll know that you're in the clear. You'll know that you've done something heroically virtuous. And to me, that seems like the better way to go. Otherwise, for the rest of your lives, you're going to always have this shadow. And you'll always have that nagging conscience bothering you.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's tough still, because I don't think she's willing to do that because of the what she perceives to be the danger of having a fifth C-section if we were to get pregnant.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that case, the church's wisdom is also applicable, and that is then get really serious about practicing natural family planning. And maybe you already know what that is, but for the benefit of those who are not clear, it's where, using observation methods, you and your wife determine when ovulation takes place during her cycle, and that's the peak fertility. And then you enjoy the benefit of the marriage act throughout the month, except for the time where the possibility of conception is high. And usually couples who want, if they have a serious reason for wanting to avoid conception, and it sounds like your wife does, then you might add a few days on either side of it. But when you're doing the charting, you can see visually month to month, this is when this happens. So if you know that this is when fertility is at its peak, and you maybe, just to be extra safe, you bracket a couple days on either side of that, well, the likelihood of conception is extremely low. It's not nil, but it's extremely low. And that would be a responsible way, cooperating with God's plan for the marriage, cooperating with his design of the female reproductive system. It's a great way for the two of you to show love to each other in a way that is not erotic. And the erotic love between a husband and a wife is certainly important, but there are many other ways to show love as well. And this helps you master your appetites. It helps you grow in love for each other, show consideration to each other. It heightens expectation. There are so many ways in which practicing natural family planning can be a great boon to your marriage. So all is not lost. If she gets her tubal ligation reversed, then natural family planning would be a way for you to do everything in the light of God's grace and never have to worry, never have a guilty conscience again. At least not on that, anyway.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with what you said. Problem is that the fourth child was born while we were practicing natural family planning, so they didn't do such a great job.
Yeah, so she's going to roll her eyes and say, yeah, we'll see how well that worked out. Well, the answer to that...
That's the roadblock.
Understandable. Understandable. Well, the thing is, it may not have worked, quote-unquote, either because you were not as cautious. Remember what I was saying about adding an extra day or two on either side of the ovulation?
Yeah.
Okay. Couples that want to make very sure, because of the woman's health or finances or war or something like that, it means that if you really, really want to make it work, you can. You just have to be more strict with yourselves for a longer period of time rather than less. And if you were to do that again, then I think you could find the happy medium and still enjoy this benefit of marriage as many times as you want. But when you recognize here's the time of the month where we need to be really careful, then you just refrain. And you ask God, invoke his blessings upon you, ask him to help you and bless you, and he will. He won't leave you high and dry.
Got it. All right. Thank you. I appreciate the explanation.
You're welcome, John. Thank you. Dr. Janet Smith has a great one-hour digital download. It's called Contraception, Why Not? And she actually talks about sterilization as well, but it has a lot to do with the pill and condoms and things like that. But overall, she lays out the moral reasons, not to mention the reasons having to do with ecology, for example, about why contraception is bad for couples. It's bad for women, especially in the form of pills and things like that. So if you're interested, I would just look that up. Janet Smith, Contraception, Why Not? ? And it's available as a digital download. And I think any married couple who's pondering this issue should really listen to that. And just as a little teaser here, when I mentioned the ecology side of it, one of the things that she points out is that how, especially with chemical contraceptives, the pill, for example, how these hormones, guess where they go? They leave your body and they go in the toilet and then they go into the septic system and then they go into the groundwater after it's gone through treatment. And, you know, the water treatment facilities in many municipalities don't filter that out. So now you've got these harmful steroids, harmful chemicals that are going into the groundwater, and any number of scientific studies have shown that they affect the ecology. It's bad for the fish, bad for the frogs, bad for whatever else is in that water. So even just if you're green and you want to help Mother Earth, it's another reason why chemical contraception is a bad idea. But it's bad in many, many other ways, as Janet Smith lays out. Hour 3 is about to start. I'll be right back with more right after this.